Good day, and welcome to the Safety and Schools conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during a question-and-answer session. Please note today's call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Christine Lucius. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning, and thank you so much for joining the call. My name is Christine Lucius, and I'm the Executive Vice President for Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition of more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. I'm happy to be here today with my colleagues in the civil and human rights movement to discuss why militarizing our schools is the wrong approach to addressing gun violence in America. There have been more than 60 mass shootings since January 1st. Of the 10 deadliest mass shootings in American history, five of them happened in the past decade. Gun violence in our country has reached epidemic proportions. It is long past time we do something about it. Unfortunately, the solutions currently under consideration at the Department of Justice and Congress are the wrong approach to a very serious problem. Federal dollars for more police in schools, metal detectors, and hotlines to report students who may be in crisis will do nothing to stop gun violence. All of our children deserve to attend a safe, high-quality school. Our children also deserve to learn in an environment without fear of either over-policing or mass shooting. Militarizing our schools will only create the illusion of safety. We need real solutions to our gun violence problem. Joining me on the call today to discuss why our federal policymakers are heading in the wrong direction and what kind of solutions should be on the table are Judith Brown Dianis, Executive Director of the Advancement Project, Kurt Decker, Executive Director of the National Disability Rights Network, and Todd Cox, Director of Policy for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. After hearing from each of our speakers, we'll have a brief question and answer session and provide instructions for how listeners can ask a question. First, we'll hear from Judith Brown Dianis, Executive Director of the Advancement Project. Judith?
Thank you. Again, my name is Judith Brown Dianis, and I'm Executive Director of the National Office of Advancement Project. We all want safe and nurturing learning environments, and schools need strategies on how to create positive, supportive learning environments that phase out law enforcement, not increase their presence. After every school shooting, I have witnessed these knee-jerk reactions to putting more police in schools, giving people the perception of safety, but not for many children. For some, adding more police and militarizing our schools creates fear, anxiety, and a sense of injustice. Police presence in schools leads to an increase in arrests for minor behaviors. Creating police states within schools and communities will not solve mass violence. In fact, it has only been a distraction from a discussion about gun control. We don't need the appearance of safety. We need real solutions that actually create safe schools or address the underlying root causes of school violence. Studies have long shown that black children are punished more often for minor subjective things, and that race matters in who gets disciplined and arrested and how harsh. In fact, studies have also shown that with regard to police, black children are seen as older and treated more harshly at the hands of police officers. School police officers should not be confused with school guidance counselors, social workers, mentors, or educators. Police officers are not usually trained in youth and adolescent development, how to handle children with disabilities, or in how to effectively interact with students and school personnel. We should not expect police to screen students for mental health issues or to act as counselors and mentors. In addition, there is a culture clash between law enforcement and educational environments. School police officers are trained to ensure compliance with the criminal code. They are not trained in how to create or sustain nurturing learning environments. The other problem with police in schools is that in many communities, especially communities of color, those communities do not trust the police on the streets, so they will not trust police in the hallways, therefore making children believe that their schools are prison-like environments. Investments in policing and armed teachers diverts critical education funding away from student supports like school psychologists, nurses, and educators to create hostile learning environments that mirror prisons and calcify the school-to-prison pipeline. Let's be clear. The Parkland tragedy did not create a new call for more police in schools. Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions wanted to increase school militarization before. Secretary Betsy DeVos wanted to rescind the anti-discrimination discipline guidance before Parkland, making discrimination easier, as she did under Title IX. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Judith. Next, we'll hear from Kurt Decker, Executive Director of the National Disability Rights Network. Kurt?
Thank you, Christine. Good morning, everyone. We at the National Disability Rights Network and the broader disability community are deeply concerned over these proposals by Attorney General Sessions, the Trump administration, and Congress to address violence in schools. A particular concern is the call for the increased number of school resource officers. There are huge risks to having an armed police presence in the schools, as evidenced by the number of accidental shootings even in the last week. In our experience, school resource officers, armed or not, do not make schools safer. Instead, they are a significant factor in making schools more hostile places for kids with disabilities, and especially kids of color with disabilities. SROs are largely untrained in the techniques educators use to de-escalate conflict. They rely too heavily on the use of handcuffs, restraint and seclusion, and referrals to the juvenile justice system for often minor infractions. We have data that shows that through the use of SROs, more children have ended up suspended or expelled from school and referred to the juvenile justice system for minor, nonviolent, and subjective infractions like disrespectful language and even dress code violations. These punishments disproportionately affect children with disabilities and children of color and are a major factor in the explosion of the school-to-prison pipeline. These experiences also have a lasting effect on children. Youth who are referred to the juvenile justice system are significantly less likely to finish school and significantly more likely to end up in the criminal justice system once they are adults. We also share the concern of the civil rights community over the proposed use of threat assessment hotlines. While we firmly believe that children in need should be referred for services as soon as that need is identified, we must ensure privacy and due process rights are protected. It's important that any referral system is evidence-based and culturally competent in its assessment of children to ensure accurate referrals, is carefully planned so it does not permit the bleed of private information from one system to another in a way that causes negative outcomes for the individuals, and does not use incarceration or institutionalization as a solution to a lack of community-based mental health services, but instead refers children to a robust system of appropriate services. Lastly, we're also concerned about the call for hardening schools with the utilization of all kinds of new door locks and other mechanical devices. Not only would this be a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it would clearly make it difficult for kids with disabilities to evacuate school premises for a variety of reasons, especially children with mobility impairments. When viewed together, it's clear that the plans proposed by Congress, the Attorney General, and the Department of Education are a roadmap for how the administration has chosen to use the school shooting crisis to remove civil rights and services from children and youth with disabilities. There is no debate that we must do all we can to keep our schools safe, but we cannot let fear drive policy decisions that make matters worse. Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. And finally, we'll hear from Todd Cox, Director of Policy for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Todd?
Thank you, Christine, and good morning. As Christine mentioned, my name is Todd Cox, and I'm the Director of Policy for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Founded in 1940 by Thurgood Marshall, LDF is the nation's oldest civil rights law organization, and for almost 80 years, LDF has relied on the Constitution and federal and state civil rights laws to pursue equality and justice for African Americans and other people of color. And continuing in that, we will continue to ensure that students of color receive quality and equitable educational opportunities. Unfortunately, we all have too much experience dealing with the aftermath of school shootings. After the incidents in Columbine, Colorado, and Sandy Hook, Connecticut, families, school districts, and lawmakers took a variety of actions intended to prevent future tragedies. In studying these actions and their consequences, we can see which efforts worked and which do not. We know that calls for increase the number and presence of police and armed school officials in schools have not proven to be effective methods of protecting all students, and rather risk further over-criminalizing children and furthering racial disparities in education. We know that best practices emphasize that safe and secure school environments are created only through focusing on maintaining a respectful and supportive school environment where students' emotional and academic needs are met. To effectively make schools safer, responses to gun violence in our schools should help to cultivate these positive environments by focusing on expanded resources such as school counselors, mental health services, social workers, and proven programs such as positive behavioral interventions and supports, and restorative practices and prohibit assigning law enforcement to schools. Proposals that would increase the use of school resource officers, so-called security measures such as metal detectors and establishing threat assessment hotlines to report students who may be in crisis, are only a small part of the strategy that experts recommend for maintaining safe school environments and may actually carry a high risk of exacerbating race-based disparities in how students are treated by school police and staff. Research has shown that having more police in schools does not make schools safer, but results in an increasing number of students being led from schools to the justice system. Although Black and Latino students do not misbehave more than white students, students of color make up over 58% of school-based arrests, but only 40% of public school enrollment. Black students are more than twice as likely as their white peers to be referred to law enforcement or arrested in school. Additionally, research shows that police officers perceive Black youth as older and more culpable than they do similarly situated white youth, and this bias leads to an over-criminalization of Black students. Furthermore, the presence of police in schools make Black students and students who have been victims feel less safe, which would negatively affect school climate. All students deserve to attend safe and welcoming schools, and we encourage Congress and the administration to provide states and districts with additional resources to achieve this goal in a manner that ensures schools provide equal educational opportunities for all students in a safe environment. If Congress and the administration truly wants our schools and students to thrive and be safe, the government must end the criminalization of our students of color and address excessive discipline that contributes to creating the school-to-prison pipeline. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd. I think we're now ready to take some questions from reporters. Erica, can you open the lines and provide instructions for asking questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, it is the star and one on your touchtone telephone. If at any point you find your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Again, that is the star and one to ask a question, and we'll pause briefly for questions to queue. And we'll go first to the line of Evie Blatt from Education Week. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Could you tell me a little bit more about your concern with threat assessment hotlines? There's one in Colorado that was started after Columbine, and they claim to have thwarted quite a few attempts. Is your concern that more students of color will be reported in the first place, or that data won't be protected effectively? What are some things that bother you about that?
Well, this is Kurt Decker at NDRN. As I said in my remarks, we certainly think that the referral systems can be useful. They just have to be properly implemented and make sure that they are evidence-based and culturally competent and not impacting one population more than another. And we are worried about the possible misuse of private information that follows these children, especially kids with disabilities, through their entire life. Once they carry that label, it's very difficult for them to get rid of it, and it affects their entire life. So these things have to be carefully looked at, and not as we've been also saying, it's just a pathway to a more incarcerated or institutionalized process. And as we said, we have the data that shows these kids go right into the juvenile justice system and then lose their education rights as a part of that.
Thank you. And again, that is the star and one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll go next to the line of Marcia Jews with Keeping It Moving. Please go ahead. Marcia, your line is open. Please check your mute switch.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So the question for me is looking at each community and what community organizations, the local NAACPs and sororities and fraternities, since they're the issue we have in Baltimore and in most urban markets, we're seeing that, as you've indicated, the large percentage of people who are being impacted are Black boys and girls. What should we really be doing? What type of legislation or what type of involvement should community leaders be focused on, and the strategy we should use with our mayors and state delegates?
Judith, can you take that one?
Sure. Hi, this is Judith Brown, Diana's Advancement Project. So what we need to be doing is really thinking about the ways in which we are investing in the future of our children, not in punishing them. And so that means looking at some of our budgets, both our city and our education budgets, to ensure that we're putting our money where our mouth is. And that means investing in counselors, investing in mental health supports, investing in programs like restorative justice. So, for example, there are schools that do restorative justice, which means that they are building relationships between young people and schools so that when there is a child who needs help, there is an adult who has a relationship with them in a school building who knows that there is a problem, that you're building trust between young people and the adults in a school building. And these programs are, like, for example, in Denver Public Schools, they have a very robust restorative justice program that is working. You're seeing children getting at root causes. That's part of the thing, is that we can't just say, let's put more police in schools. That will lead to punishment. That will not get at root causes. That will not support young people. And so we need to be looking at these kinds of alternatives instead of just militarizing our schools.
If I could jump in there, this is Kurt Decker at NDRN. We in the disability community have had a 50-year history with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a very strong entitlement to a free and appropriate education for all kids with disabilities. And within that are a whole set of procedures from assessment, early identification, programming, and a whole process of due process to protect the rights of those kids. If Betsy DeVos really wanted to see better schools, she would have a vigorous enforcement of the IDEA throughout the country and make sure that all those processes that are in there are fully implemented. And that, I think, would clearly identify kids that may have these kinds of problems, but also provide a way of programming for those kids and not just kicking them out and expelling them as so how now happens.
And this is Judith. I wanted to add one other thing, is that we need more schools to be also doing, writing into their budgets implicit bias assessments and training for teachers, because we need to understand that it's not always the young people who are the so-called problem. First of all, they're not a problem. But second, we need to be looking sometimes at the adults in a building, because we know that our suspension rates and often what we criminalize is a matter of how we perceive the young person who's standing in front of us. And so being able to do assessments to see whether or not teachers and staff have implicit bias, and then doing training in order for them to not act on that implicit bias, is very important, and also giving them classroom management training, but also the other supports and other kinds of professionals that they need in the classroom and in the school to help when they need the extra help and support for a young person.
Thank you. And as a reminder, it is star and one to ask a question, and we'll go next to Tricia Crane from AL.com. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So along that line of this implicit bias, how do you, educators see this differently, right? I think it was Mr. Cox said, you know, black and brown children don't misbehave more, but educators see it differently. What are those initial actions? I mean, a lot of them don't believe they even need implicit bias training, right? It's like there's this stone wall that you can't break through. What are some initial actions that schools can take to determine or sort of to own that problem and see if it exists?
So this is Judith. I brought it up. I'll weigh in first. This is Judith Brown Dianis again. With regard to implicit bias, one of the things that school districts should be doing is really doing a deep dive into their discipline data. In schools across the country, what you see is that young people of color, especially black children, even as young as 5 years old and in pre-K, are being suspended for very subjective things that have absolutely nothing to do with school safety. And so being able to dive into that data to understand what are we suspending young people for, what are we calling the cops in for, what role are police officers playing in our schools? When you look at that data and you see that, I think Kurt mentioned, that young people of color are being suspended more often for disrespect, insubordination, and things like that are in the eye of the beholder, then you have to understand that there's something else that's going on, that it's not just the young people of color, and in fact, studies show that it is not, it does come down to race. And so being able to look at that and then go into the actual discipline files to understand what was it that ticked a teacher off. Are there particular teachers that are having problems? That's the other thing, is let's cut the data in ways that gets down to the classroom level to understand who's doing the suspensions, why are they suspending young people, and are these for more subjective things? And when you look at it and you see the more subjectivity, then you do know that there's probably a problem and it's based on race.
Thank you. And as a reminder, it is the star and one to ask a question. We'll pause for further questions to queue. And we'll go next to the line of Mel Lenore. Lenore from Politico, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. This question is for Kurt. You spoke about concerns with school building security measures, and you said that some could violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. Can you expand on that and maybe share some examples with us?
Yes. So we have been experiencing, even before the shootings, that there are some very aggressive marketing by companies that create door locks and other kinds of devices to try to harden the school. And again, this is done out of a misguided fear of safety, that somehow if you make the doors locked harder, the shooter won't get in. I mean, the first thing you want to know is, well, also means the shooter can't get out. But in the meantime, you've now made it very difficult for the whole range of kids with disabilities to evacuate quickly and safely out of the building for a variety of reasons, a fire or any kind of environmental hazard that might occur in the school. And so we believe that the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, actually requires that there be easy access, easy ability to evacuate a building, and these additional types of equipment, again, well-meaning possibly, but will really make the school even more difficult and unsafe for those kids, especially, as I said, kids with mobility impairments, kids who maybe have a lower IQ and need to follow instructions. And so we're very concerned that, these companies are really utilizing this whole experience to sell their product.
Thank you. And we'll go next to the line of David Disroches from Public Radio. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I have a question for Todd Cox, or anybody really, but Todd, you mentioned that the important thing is to keep school climate safe. But I'm wondering, how does that prevent somebody, an outside threat, from coming in and potentially hurting people in the school? So what sort of measures do you guys support in terms of outside threats to students and teachers in schools?
Sure. Well, I don't think anyone is suggesting that we don't have secure schools. We aren't suggesting that we somehow leave schools vulnerable to outside attacks. I think what we're talking about, though, is how people are reacting to the particular instances of school violence that we're seeing. And the way they are reacting are in ways that really have not proven to keep schools safe. And so, for example, school resource officers arming folks within the schools. We know, and we think from our own experiences, that the kinds of recommendations that, for example, the school discipline guidance puts on the table are much more effective tools for making sure that our schools are ultimately kept safe. So while, you know, we aren't saying that schools should be left vulnerable to outside attack, I think what we're responding to are the, frankly, incorrect or misguided responses to the current attacks, the current tragedy that has occurred in Florida, and are really proposals that are put on the table that actually could do more harm than any good.
Thank you. And again, that is the star and one if you would like to ask a question. We'll go to a follow-up from Marcia Jews. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much. I heard all of the responses, and they were really great. Thank you. But as we start talking about getting into the budgets of our local school systems, it sounds like an issue. Is there, sounds like an issue where there needs to be legislation that's drafted, because now we're talking about budgeting in the school system and rearranging the budget to create this additional staffing or sector within the guidance counselor office, or maybe expanding that with teacher professional development and training. What would you recommend? Is there, I guess I'm speaking directly to the Legal Defense Fund at the NAACP, is there some sort of legislation that you all have already written somewhere to help us formulate something to be able to give to our community, for our mayor and for the state of Maryland? Baltimore is primarily run by the state, and I'm sure that there are other cities that have that same issue, but how would we go about that so that we can articulate it properly to our legislators for it to go into the House for the next session?
Sure. I think many of the interventions that we've been describing on this phone call are contained in something that was released by the Department of Justice and the Department of Education in 2014, and that's the school discipline guidance. And it lays out, frankly, a series of steps that schools can take to improve school climates, to make sure those climates are not school environments are not operating in a way that are discriminatory, that actually cause students harm, and that would invariably lead students into the school prison pipeline. So I think that, you know, in many ways, schools have been on notice probably since I think Title VI was put in place, that it needed to have these kinds of tools in place. However, in 2014, under the Obama administration, they put it in stark relief exactly what schools need to do to ensure that their environment is operating in a non-discriminatory manner. And so there's really nothing new that's required. Schools already should be in compliance and should be have in place the tools and the kinds of resources that we've been talking about. That said, I think schools that do not have those in place, I would commend them to the guidance that the 2014 guidance, which I'm happy to send your way, or have our folks send your way. That's really a roadmap for making sure that many of the responses that we think are appropriate to this latest tragedy are put in place.
Thank you. And we'll take a follow-up from Tricia Crane with AL.com.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my follow-up. So here in Alabama, we have the National Association of School Resource Officer headquarters, and I know that SRO, school resource officer, is sort of a generic term. NASRO folks are very careful to separate you know, between people who are NASRO trained versus those who are not. And they're pretty adamant about, you know, no non-NASRO trained SROs should be in schools. I mean, they don't really say it that way, but mostly they say it that way. Do y'all recognize any difference between, I mean, is that a distinction that y'all make? I think it was Mr. Decker that spoke about, you know, that, you know, SROs don't make schools safer. Anyone?
Well, this is Kurt Decker again from NDRN. We're not not familiar with the content of the training of the SROs, but our experience has been that the SROs in general just don't know how to work with kids with disabilities and don't recognize some of the behavior issues that are a manifestation of a disability. So a kid with autism or a kid with other kind of possible mental health issues who is acting out, I mean, there's no question that some of these kids with disabilities do some behaviors that need to be dealt with, but we would prefer to be dealt with by trained teachers, and as Todd said, who have PBIS, positive behavior support training, rather than a school officer who really sort of comes out of the whole criminal justice policing mentality and is not familiar with these kids with some of their behaviors. I mean, it's a problem we have in the disability community writ large. I'm constantly having police in general not really understanding how to work with someone with cerebral palsy or autism or some of the behaviors they just don't understand and misdiagnose because they haven't been trained.
Thank you.
Hi, and this is Judith Brown Dianis. So I just wanted to add to that first of all, the training that NASRO does is not required, first of all, for all school resource officers across the country. They also do absolutely no training on implicit bias. They have just recently started doing some training about adolescent mental health training, but that's not even part of their initial training for school resource officers. And what we also have to understand is that school resource officers are officers who come from a local police department. They are the person who is funded by a different line item, usually that comes from the federal government, that funding. They are the person who is assigned to a school. So they are first trained to be a police officer. And they, again, are not trained to be in a nurturing educational environment. So we don't treat them any differently, and to the extent that they say that they are different and that they are there for guidance, no. There are people who are trained professionally to be guidance counselors, who are trained in youth development. They don't carry a gun. They don't have a badge. They're called guidance counselors. They're called mental health counselors. And those are the people who should be in our schools.
Thank you.
Thank you. And as a reminder, it is star and one if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll take a follow-up from David Disroches. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I would have asked this earlier, following up on Mr. Cox's response to my question, but it's sort of pushing back on that a little bit. And sort of following up on what Kurt was talking about, where he mentioned, I think, the hardening of schools is something that concerns him based on access, ADA compliance, and things like that. So I'm just curious from the group, when we are talking about external threats, because, I mean, a lot of these solutions you guys are discussing are very much within the school itself, but in terms of external threats, like what sort of school security measures would be still ADA compliant or would still respect kids with disabilities or, you know, any other vulnerable student populations? What sort of measures do you guys support in terms of protecting students from external threats?
Well, I this is Kurt. I would say I assume there's probably two classifications of external threats. One would be students themselves, either in the school or former students. And again, if the IDEA is being properly implemented, some of those kids would be identified, hopefully through the assessment and screening process. For people who are not related to the school, external people who just want to create havoc and fear in a school, I don't have any strong recommendations, but I think the idea that there is some magic solution to try to keep someone who's clearly bent on creating havoc in a school, I think will be very difficult. But because of that fear, it seems that people are overreacting internally and thinking that there's all kinds of internal things that can be done that somehow is going to prevent that person from outside from getting in.
And this is Judith Brown-Dianis. After Newtown, a lot of schools did put in place measures to keep schools safe from an outside intruder, which, you know, includes having locks on all the doors from the exterior, having a bell and at the front door, having even an entryway that the person that's coming into the school goes into an entryway that is, you know, that takes you into the office, not into the rest of the school building. So there are ways to secure a building without having somebody who is armed and putting more guns in our schools. And I just wanted to also mention for people on the call that you can find, we have a policy brief called Police in Schools Are Not the Answer to School Shootings that was done by Advancement Project, the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, the Alliance for Educational Justice and Dignity in Schools, and it is on our website, which is www.advancementproject.org, advancementproject.org.
And let me just add, this is Kurt Decker again. We in the disability community, we've experienced, the problem of safety always trumping accessibility, and whether it's a response to 9/11, where airports were, made, quote, more secure, which then cut down on the ability of people with disabilities to access thing, and now we're sort of experiencing the same idea. We've worked for decades to make schools accessible for the full range of kids with disabilities so they could be mainstreamed and not segregated, and yet now the idea of a one entrance, if that's not the accessible entrance, then we have a very serious problem of, once again, moving kids with disabilities out of the mainstream.
Thank you. And as a reminder, again, it is star and one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll pause briefly for any further follow-ups or questions to queue. It does not appear we have any further questions at this time, so I'd like to turn the conference back over to Ms. Christine Lucius. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you so much for joining today's call. We appreciate your attention to this urgent matter. If you have further questions, please reach out to my colleague, Corelli Hernandez. Thank you.